for you to fight for what you want.
Yeah.
Right? You would lose different groups of people, different indigenous groups, and even just areas in general. Obviously, there is some wisdom behind eating meat.
Yeah.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
But then what about people who do, like, wastefully using meat?
I think that's in everything, right? Mm. It's not just meat.
Mm.
It's don't go into so much of a surplus of just anything. Suppose you're drinking water, but drink water to an extent that you need it. Don't waste it and go overboard with this, right? I think these advocates for, suppose, vegetarians or vegans, they're looking at those people who are, like, I guess, either overeating and just consuming a lot of meat, or they're throwing a lot of it away, right? It's just complete and utter, like, destruction of, like, suppose, just animals, just cutting them left and right, right? So it says in the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt as well to keep everything to an extent, right? Don't go overboard and don't, I guess, to an extent, don't go under as well, right? There's a middle ground that you're supposed to follow here, right? So it's not, okay, you know, if you're eating meat, you know, and animals being slaughtered, they're going through pain, okay, so then just cut that off.
Yeah.
Right?
I even was wondering why when we are offering prayers, why we, you know, stand in the center. It is, again, teaching you the concept of being intermediate. Don't go too extreme, or don't go like the Brother Jaffer said right now. And apart from that, like you said earlier, the nutrients. We have nutrients in pulses or some other vegetables that are equal to the nutrients in the meat. But maybe you need to consume more. You need to consume more pulses. You need to consume more. But meat in itself, like, alone has fats plus proteins plus so many nutrients.
What they're actually doing now, sister, is they're promoting insect food. And I don't know if you've seen this, but they have fully-fledged restaurants and stuff where they're selling beetle larvae, they're selling worms and maggots and things like that. Because pound for pound, they actually contain more protein. They contain more nutrients than meat. And they're saying that this is the healthier way to do it. So, you know, the nutritional arguments, they're really kind of racking them up against. Okay, so as a closing thought, think about this. For those who want scientific arguments for why we should consume meat, because a lot of people, they're not only vegetarian, they actually become vegan, which means that they won't have any animal products at all. They even avoid milk. They even avoid eggs. And so for such people, a scientific argument for them would be that, look, when you consume soya products, for example, it increases the estrogen in men. And testosterone that you're supposed to get from meat. It's not just about the protein. It's not just about the apparent nutritional benefits of such food. It's about the things that we don't yet understand. And so Allah has, as the sister said, as Sister Zainab said, quite rightly, there is a system that Allah has placed for us. He has created us and designed us for this world. And he's set certain limits so that we don't exceed those limits. Now, if we look at our own creation, this is the final point because we've run out of time. If you look at the teeth of an animal, right, the teeth of an animal which is a herbivore, which is designed to only eat vegetables, it will have molar-like teeth, right, the flat kind of teeth. But then if you look at animals which are designed by Allah to eat meat, they will have incisor-type teeth, you know, those sharp, pointy kind of teeth, like lions and tigers, and they eat meat. Human beings have been given both. Isn't that beautiful? Like, we have the flat teeth at the back.
I told you he has
come
with complete research.
Right?
Yeah.
We have the molars at the back, and then we also have incisors. And that shows us that we are omnivores, here to eat both. Sister Zainab, Sayyid Jafar, thank you very much for being on the show. That's all we have time for, unfortunately. Dear listeners, we hope that you enjoyed and benefited from the show. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي أما رايزك لتصي دليلتك
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The United States has approved its biggest defense spending bill in history, allocating $778 billion for the fiscal year 2022. President Joe Biden signed the National Defense Authorization Act into law on Monday following Congress approval. The proposed defense spending is up about 5% compared to the previous year. However, the surprising part of the story is that Congress has allocated about $25 billion more for the military than the Biden administration had requested for. The budget allocates over $740 billion to the Pentagon, while nearly $28 billion would go to nuclear weapons program. A good portion will be spent on hypersonic weapons and other advanced weaponry, raising the fear of another arms race with Russia. It ensures that the U.S. gives around $3.8 billion to Israel as part of its annual military aid to the regime. But around $7 billion of the hefty defense budget is for what the U.S. calls the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, a plan to strengthen America's presence in the Indo-Pacific region against China. That also means an open call for support for Taiwan, which China regards as its own territory. The budget also envisages $300 million in military aid for Ukraine, which has been a source of tensions between Russia and the U.S.-led Western military alliance, NATO. Many experts believe that Washington's claim of defending Taiwan or Ukraine are just pretexts to make the U.S. military-industrial complex more profitable.
The military industry, military-industrial complex in the States, it really controls the economy. This idea that America's trying to defend Taiwan or Ukraine, these are just pretexts for the profits of the military-industrial complex.
According to data released by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute in April, the massive U.S. military budget was by far the largest in the world in 2021. That was more than the budget of 11 other developed and developing countries combined. That despite the fact that COVID-19 forced many countries, such as South Korea and Russia, to shift part of their planned military spending to pandemic response. Critics argue that the unwarranted increase in defense budget could instead be diverted to address more urgent domestic priorities, such as social injustice or fighting against the pandemic. The critics also say that the budget is more than enough to vaccinate everyone in the world. In July, an anti-war group, Code Pink, warned that the proposed $25 billion hike in the Pentagon budget alone could end homelessness in the United States. The group accused lawmakers of trying to increase the profits of military contractors than meeting the needs of working class. The approved military spending bill also represents a bump from former President Donald Trump's last budget of $740 billion, which was then criticized by Biden's fellow Democrats. Upon entering the White House in January, President Biden pledged a massive overhaul of U.S. strategy toward the world to make it a better place. However, Biden continues to follow Trump's aggressive and warmongering policies, as the National Defense Authorization Act reflects that billions of dollars will go for the U.S. unending wars across the globe.
Hundreds of people demonstrated in Gaza City in solidarity with female Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. Protesters marched towards the Legislative Council building while shouting slogans against Israel and expressing their unwavering support for the prisoners. In recent weeks, Israeli forces increased their attacks against Palestinian female prisoners. The issue of female Palestinian prisoners is highly emotive to all Palestinians. The protest was organized by the Al-Ahrar movement.
Palestinian female prisoners are being attacked inside Israeli prisons and we will not remain silent. Attacking female prisoners is an attack on the honor of all Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims. They were beaten and their ribs were broken by the prison guards. We stand by the prisoners and we will spare no effort to secure their release from Zionist jails.
Palestinians believe that Israel can only be forced into releasing Palestinian inmates under prisoner swap deals. In late 2011, Hamas and the Israeli regime signed a prisoner swap deal under which Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit was released in exchange for over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the issue of Palestinian female prisoners is a red line that must not be crossed at any given time. Attacking and humiliating Palestinian female prisoners will not go unpunished. The Israeli regime will have to face all the consequences of attacking the female prisoners. As we stand here today, we say to all Palestinian prisoners that the resistance factions will always support them and that we will soon liberate them from Zionist jails.
Palestinian prisoners, including females, are kept in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers and are being subjected to torture and psychological pressures by Israeli prison authorities.
The Zionist regime is trying to commit genocide against Palestinian prisoners amid the silence and normalization of Arab regimes. We call on all Muslims to stand by Palestinian prisoners because Palestinian prisoners are fighting for a just cause. We have also sent a strong warning to the Zionist enemy over the issue of female Palestinian prisoners.
According to legal experts, the Israeli regime has long regarded itself above international laws and norms due to the protection it enjoys from some countries like the United States.
People here are demanding international action to support Palestinian prisoners' struggle for freedom. Israel currently incarcerates some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners, including scores of women and children. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The Saudi war on Yemen has been ongoing for more than 7 years now. Far from home, Yemeni students in Iran gathered in Tehran to commemorate the victims of the war.
We Yemeni students have gathered here today to once again shed light on Saudi Arabia's crimes in our country. Saudi Arabia is bombarding innocent children and women in our country. Why is the UN keeping mum? Where is the Human Rights Watch? Aren't we considered human?
Saudi Arabia launched the war on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing former Yemeni President Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi back to power. The Yemeni army and its allied forces are leading the anti-Saudi resistance in the country. They say while Saudi Arabia is enjoying all-out support from its Western allies in its war, Yemeni forces have made headways against the invaders, turning the devastating war into a costly quagmire for Riyadh.
Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve its goals in our country. We have resisted for more than 7 years and shifted the balance in our favor. Despite the use of American and British arms, Riyadh will never be able to impose its will on our nation.
The ongoing bombardment of civilian facilities has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead and destroyed the infrastructure of the impoverished country, not to mention the spread of infectious diseases and famine. Saudi Arabia has also imposed an all-out blockade against Yemen.
The Saudi war on Yemen is condemned here as a crime against humanity, a crime that continues to be ignored by the responsible entities in the world. Yemeni students here say this means it's up to the Yemeni people to take the matter into their own hands and continue their resistance until the country is finally free. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
With France's presidential election just 4 months away, Europe's largest Muslim community is being scapegoated and targeted by government repression as badly as ever. Almost 100 mosques have recently been raided by the government, with at least 24 shut down so far. Earlier this year, a so-called anti-separatist law was accused of basically legalizing Islamophobia, as it tried to ban the hijab for minors and force the closure of not just mosques, but highly respected Muslim NGOs, such as the Collective Against French Islamophobia. The latest assault on freedom of religion for French Muslims has been sharply criticized by foreign leaders and top NGOs.
France is a republic which claims to be very attached to the idea that the state must be neutral towards all religions. But the past year has seen an incredibly tough interference and meddling in the Muslim community. They're entering mosques and telling religious leaders to say this and to not say that. And this reflects the shift to the extreme right of President Emmanuel Macron's government.
The dominant theme of France's entire presidential election has shifted to the extreme right, as convicted racist Eric Zemmour has provided coronavirus-era France with almost nightly Islamophobic diatribes. Zemmour has rocketed to third place in the polls, giving Macron and other candidates license to blame Muslims for France's economic and political problems.
Zemmour resembles Donald Trump of the United States in that both thrive on outrage, but there are significant differences. Zemmour's entire career has been based around trying to be a part of the political scene and conversation, and he has benefited from support from major parts of the French establishment the entire time.
Il est invité dans tous les plateaux.
Zemmour is invited onto all the television news programs, even though he's a political pyromaniac who is trying to rehabilitate the era of Vichy France, when France collaborated with the German Nazis. He's very dangerous for all of France, and not just France's Muslims, because he's appealing to those who sympathize with the era of French colonial barbarism.
Ever since the Great Recession began, France's political and media elite have stigmatized Muslims to a degree which has gutted the nation's claim to be a global leader in freedom of religion, thought, and speech. The three most popular candidates in the presidential election all seem to be trying to outdo each other in Islamophobia, which has France's Muslims expecting the state-sponsored racism to be even worse over the next 4 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks says the eighth round of negotiations aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action will be focusing on the two issues of verification and guarantees.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has announced that if an agreement is reached, the side that violated the deal, meaning the U.S., should remove the sanctions first. Iran should verify the removal of sanctions and only then take measures within the framework of the JCPOA.
Ali Bagheri-Kani says the U.S., which withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 under the administration of Donald Trump, also needs to provide guarantees it will not withdraw again or impose sanctions in violation of the deal.
Iran's rightful and logical demand has been getting guarantees from the other side, and this, as well as the issue of verification, have in principle been accepted by them. But discussions need to take place on the mechanism, frameworks and criteria involved in order to reach a framework for an agreement.
Bagheri said the sides are set to discuss banking and financial sanctions in the coming days. Meanwhile, EU coordinator Enrico Mora says the talks need to end within a reasonable period of time, which, according to him, should be a matter of weeks rather than months. Mora said difficult political decisions need to be made, both in Tehran and Washington. Iran says if the other side shows it's ready to effectively remove sanctions and give the necessary guarantees, the talks can conclude successfully. Talks will continue at the level of experts and deputy foreign ministers in the coming days as efforts intensify to make the challenging prospect of a restored JCPOA a reality. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
It was the year UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson pledged to build back better. Some critics argued this was not just about restoring the UK's fiscal position after the ravages of COVID on the economy, but on reviving the country's international reputation that had taken a global hit after a few glaring missteps. If Johnson was hoping for a glorious scorecard to see out his political year, he was going to be left disappointed. Not only had he failed to make vital political inroads on the international stage, some pointed to the UK having gone backwards in some respects.
Britain no longer has this huge empire that it once had. It doesn't have a presence in any serious sense east of Suez. It was badly defeated in Afghanistan over the summer. It was 20 years of war, which has shown that we've come completely full circle as a result of that war. And therefore there's Britain is being kind of cut down to size, I think, in terms of, you know, when people look at it. Its actual role in the world is much less.
For those expecting something different when it came to the sometimes subservient relationship that exists between Washington and London, well, 2021 was yet another year of disappointment, with the US setting the political agenda and Britain following that well-trodden path. The White House meeting between the US President Joe Biden and Britain's bumbling PM underscored the power imbalance between the two nations. After the trade deals dangled by the Trump administration failed to materialize, Johnson returned from Washington with nothing like the $300 billion in agreements, not that you'd sense the crushing disappointment at the time.
Then, of course, there's the progress that we're making in the defense technology partnership that you've led and with our Australian friends. That I think has great potential to benefit the whole of the world and the security of the whole of the world. So, Joe, thank you for having us. And I think, you know, we're boosting our shared agenda. We want to build back the world together with you. And I think we want to renew and strengthen our transatlantic bond. And it feels to me like it's going very, very well.
The shambolic withdrawal and embarrassing military climb down experienced by Britain's military after the US announced it was leaving Afghanistan exposed the UK's strategic weaknesses and had the minister in charge at the time attempting to explain the chaos away.
Of course, didn't put.
So that's a lie.
We did not put the welfare of animals above individuals. I'm not accusing anyone of lying. I'm just correcting the facts. What is certainly true is that we had a lot of people rushing to get out of Afghanistan for all sorts of reasons. And I think it's right that we had a process in place.
Not only was the UK caught on the back foot having to follow the US on the Afghanistan issue, its foreign policy position continues to ape Washington's agenda on China, Russia, Iran, Yemen, and Palestine, to name but a few. Perhaps the only area of foreign policy divergence is Brexit, where Washington has reiterated its pro-Brussels sentiments. Britain's most complicated and increasingly acrimonious foreign policy situation is the one that London and Brussels now find themselves in. Having exited the European Union, Britain now finds itself at odds with its former ally. A situation that has not been this bad in decades. Lord Frost passing the job of securing Britain's post-Brexit policies onto Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, it will be an uphill task for 2022.
The trade deals that Britain has made since Brexit have amounted to very little, including there hasn't been one with the United States. And therefore, Britain is sort of desperately trying to cling on to this military role, while at the same time the wider economic issues are not necessarily going in their favour.
Britain's continued political pivot towards the US remains a risky strategy that has yet to bear genuine fruits for the UK in its own aims, with the country's Prime Minister still in bombastic, flag-waving mood. Perhaps Boris Johnson feels tethering the UK's fortunes so closely to that of the US is still the way to go, despite new global realities indicating otherwise. Amina Taylor, London.
A meeting was held here in Western Kabul to bring the Islamic Emirate and the people closer together. The meeting was organized by a Shia association to pave the way for national solidarity in Afghanistan. During the meeting, the religious leaders and the Taliban officials stressed the need for mutual trust between people and the government.
One of the main responsibilities of the ruling group is nation building.
Afghan nation is mainly composed of our Shia and Sunni brothers. We are part of United Ummah of Islam. In order to have a united Afghanistan, we should trust each other and rely on mutual values. The new government needs to represent all sections and ethnicities of Afghanistan.
Conspiracy is one of US and the Soviet Union's main heritages in our country. They destroyed the soil with it. The Islamic Emirate need to find a way for creating unity in Afghanistan. We are all Muslims, and we believe in God. Anyone who lives in Afghanistan is entitled to live in peace and play their role in the reconstruction of the country.
The religious leaders warn against foreign interference in Afghanistan and stress the urgency to get united.
The only thing that our country needs is peace and unity. We should build trust and get united. We must distinguish between our friends and enemies.
After taking power in August, the Taliban leaders have repeatedly held talks with the Shia community, seeking their support and allegiance. Shia Afghans support an Islamic government, but believe it must be an inclusive one. They want to see people in power who make Afghanistan a safe place for all. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
As the world marks International Day of Epidemic Preparedness, Gaza's health sector continues to suffer due to the hermetic Israeli blockade in place since 2007. On Sunday, the Ministry of Health in Gaza announced the discovery of the first case of Omicron COVID variant in the blockaded enclave. Around 1,700 Gazans have already died because of the coronavirus since last year. The Gaza Strip, which is one of the world's most densely populated areas, has recorded nearly 190,000 COVID-19 infections since May 2020.
We have discovered the first case of the Omicron variant in the Gaza Strip, and this indicates that this variant was now spreading among the population. The discovery poses a new challenge to the enclave's weak health system. Omicron is a fast-spreading variant and highly infectious, and will be dominant among the coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli blockade and multiple wars have had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver. The Israeli regime also maintains tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medicines and hospital equipment, to combat COVID-19 and its variants. People in Gaza are bracing themselves for the worst following the local discovery of the Omicron variant.
The Gaza Strip's health system is fragile because of the Israeli blockade. We are afraid of Omicron because we know that it is extremely lethal. Gaza is not prepared for Omicron, and we are praying for a miracle.
The Ministry of Health in Gaza needs all the support it can get in order to combat this deadly variant. We don't have enough hospital beds or medicines because of the Israeli blockade. We call on all international organizations to help us combat the coronavirus, especially the Omicron variant.
The Israeli regime has compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for over 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza, making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic.
Israeli inhumane practices have battered Gaza's health system. Experts say that the Omicron variant will only worsen the health situation in the blockaded enclave. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the role and position of family. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the role and position of the family. We know that the family has two main things in it. When we talk about the family, a family is a place of peace, and also the family is a place of training and nurturing. When we look at the factor of the peace, that it is a place of peace, and we look at the relation of husband and wife, we can compare what is happening out there in the material life and what does Islam talks about. When we look at the material life, we see that according to the material worldview, marriage or spouse, which is the legal way, its legal way is marrying, the marriage is known as to fulfill the lust that two parties have. Or maybe they love to have kids. That's what it looks at. So therefore, when we look at the family, when we look at the relation between the husband and wife, according to the worldview, according to the material worldview, we see that it is just a matter of lust, entertainment, or maybe sex only. And on the other hand, when we ask them why you guys have married, it is said that we were ready to have responsibilities or to take responsibilities. Now, in the Islamic viewpoint, when we look at the marriage, having a lust through this, the halal way of enjoying the lust or the relation between husband and wife, it's halal ways through marriage. And Islam says this is one of the tools in order to reach to peace, because it is a need of human. And when it's a need of human, he must fulfill his need through the halal way, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A2Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about role and position of family in the Islamic lifestyle, and we said that according to the Islamic viewpoint, marriage, which brings peace or relation between husband and wife, which involves all kinds of relation, this is a way and a tool to bring peace into family, fulfilling each one's desires. It's a need, a human need, which comes through the family. And this peace will give us some inner peace, some mental peace, this relation. And after that, it will result in supplicating or praying or worshiping Allah in its best way. Therefore, when we have our needs fulfilled through the family, maybe it's the need of a husband or need of a wife, when it has been fulfilled within the family, therefore, these people will not go away and they will seek the needs through the halal means. But on the other hand, when we look at the material worldview, because they just look at the marriage for the fulfilling the purpose of something, a relation between husband and wife and having kids, and it's all responsibility. Therefore, in today's world, we can see that our new generations are not going towards marriages. They say we are not ready to marry. Why? Because they think marriage is a responsibility and that's it, nothing else. Whereas they can fulfill their desires, lusts, through having friendship or having non-halal or through forbidden ways, unlawful ways, committing adultery and rest of things which has been explained in Islam. Therefore, we need to be very much careful in this case, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A2Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. prosecutors say if the 6th of January panel finds new evidence about former President Donald Trump's role interfering with Congress's job to certify Joe Biden's election, that could help buttress a potential case by the Department of Justice. We now present you an article written by Peter Shaw. The piece is titled, Legal Experts Say Trump Could Face Charges for Trying to Obstruct Certification of Election. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Former prosecutors and other experts say expectation is growing that former U.S. President Donald Trump might face charges for trying to obstruct Congress from certifying Joe Biden's election this year as a House panel collects more evidence into the 6th of January attack on the Capitol. Speculation about possible charges against the former U.S. President Donald Trump has been heightened by a recent rhetorical bombshell from Republican Representative and 6th of January panel Vice Chair Liz Cheney, suggesting the House panel is looking at whether Trump broke a law that bars obstruction of official proceedings. Former prosecutors say if the panel finds new evidence about Trump's role interfering with Congress's job to certify Joe Biden's election, that could help buttress a potential case by the Department of Justice. Department of Justice veterans say in varying ways, Liz Cheney's comments have been echoed by two other members of the House Select Committee, Republican Adam Kinzinger and Democrat Jamie Raskin, spurring talks of how an obstruction statute could apply to Trump, which would entail the panel making a criminal referral of evidence for the Justice Department to investigate. Former Justice Department officials say Liz Cheney's remarks raising the specter of criminal charges against Donald Trump came twice earlier this month at hearings of the committee. Experts believe the charges could be well-founded given Donald Trump's actions on 6th of January, including incendiary remarks to a rally just before the Capitol attack and failure to act for hours to stop the rioting. Former Department of Justice Inspector General and former prosecutor Michael Bromwich, in a statement to The Guardian, said, based on what is already in the public domain, there's powerful evidence that numerous people in and out of government attempted to obstruct, and did obstruct, at least for a while, an official proceeding, that is, the certification of the presidential election. Michael Bromwich added, that is a crime. Former prosecutors say although a House panel referral of obstruction by Donald Trump would not force the Department of Justice to open a criminal case against him, it could help provide more evidence for one and build pressure on the Justice Department to move forward. Attorney General Merrick Garland has declined to say so far whether his department may be investigating Donald Trump and his top allies already for their roles in the Capitol assault. The panel has amassed significant evidence including more than 30,000 records and interviews with more than 300 people, among whom were some key White House staff. The evidence against Donald Trump himself could include his actions at the Stop the Steal rally not far from the White House, where he urged backers to march to the Capitol and fight like hell, or you're not going to have a country anymore. Donald Trump then resisted multiple pleas for hours from Republicans and others to urge his violent supporters to stop the attack on the Capitol. Recent ruling by Trump-appointed district court judges have supported using the obstruction statute, which federal prosecutors have cited in about 200 cases involving rioters charged by the Department of Justice for their roles in the Capitol assault that injured about 140 police officers and left 5 people dead. Still, experts note that the House panel's mission has been to assemble a comprehensive report of what took place on 6th of January and work on legislation to avoid such assaults on democracy. They caution that any criminal referral to Department of Justice documenting Trump's obstruction of Congress will take time and more evidence to help bolster a Department of Justice investigation. Some Department of Justice veterans say that any referral to Department of Justice by the House panel for a criminal case against Donald Trump and perhaps top allies such as former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, whom the House recently cited for criminal contempt for refusing to be deposed, might also include Trump's aggressive pressuring of federal and state officials before 6th of January to block Joe Biden's election win with baseless charges of fraud. Bromwich stressed that evidence is steadily accumulating that would prove obstruction beyond a reasonable doubt. The ultimate question is who the defendants would be in such an obstruction case. Evidence is growing that, as a matter of law and fact, that could include Donald Trump, Mark Meadows, and other members of Trump's inner circle. Liz Cheney teed up the issue about Trump's potential culpability first at a House panel hearing recently, when she urged that Mark Meadows be held in contempt for refusing to be deposed, and then hit Donald Trump with a rhetorical bombshell. Liz Cheney said, "We know hours passed with no action by the President to defend the Congress and the United States from an assault while we were counting electoral votes. Did Donald Trump, through action or inaction, corruptly seek to obstruct or impede Congress's official proceeding to count electoral votes?" Liz Cheney's comments about Donald Trump are very precise, including language from the criminal obstruction statute, and she stated that her question is a key one for the panel's legislative task. Democrat Senator Jamie Raskin, too, has told the website Politico that the issue of whether Donald Trump broke the law by obstructing an official proceeding is clearly one of the things on the mind of some of the members of the House committee. Paul Rosenzweig, a former Department of Justice prosecutor who worked on Ken Starr's team during the impeachment of former President Bill Clinton, said, "The possibility of obstruction charges is legally valid," noting that the two district judges appointed by Donald Trump have recently said that the statute covers the efforts on 6th of January to stop the electoral count. For instance, Judge Dabney Friedrich, in a recent opinion, rejected the claim for some defendants who were challenging the Department of Justice's view that the 6th of January meeting of Congress fit the legal definition of an official proceeding. Rosenzweig posited that given Donald Trump's various attempts before 6th of January to undermine the election results, a broader conspiracy case may be another option for prosecutors to pursue. Former prosecutors say Should Department of Justice look at broader conspiracy charges, Donald Trump's persistent pressures on acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen and his top deputy for help blocking Joe Biden's election victory would probably be relevant. On one call on 27th of December 2020, Donald Trump pressed Jeffrey Rosen and his deputy to falsely state the election illegal and corrupt, despite the fact that the Department of Justice has not found any evidence of widespread voter fraud. Paul Peltier, a former acting chief of fraud section at Department of Justice, said that Liz Cheney's statements were carefully crafted and obviously based upon evidence the committee had seen. Should Congress ultimately refer the case to Department of Justice for investigation and prosecution, the Department of Justice's investigation would not be limited to a single obstruction charge, but would more likely investigate broader conspiracy charges, potentially involving Donald Trump and other key loyalists. The panel has accelerated its pace recently by sending out dozens of subpoenas for documents and depositions, some to close Donald Trump aides. Mark Meadows has become a central focus of the inquiry, in part over tweets he received on and near the insurrection that are among approximately 9,000 documents he gave the panel, much to Donald Trump's chagrin. As Trump's effort to thwart the panel from moving forward have had limited success, he has relied on sending out splenetic email attacks, including one recently that read, "The Unselect Committee itself is rigged, stacked with never-Trumpers, Republican enemies, and two disgraced rhinos, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, who couldn't get elected dog-catcher in their districts." Despite Donald Trump's angry attacks on the panel, some former prosecutors say that prosecuting Trump, if enough evidence is found to merit charges, is important for the health of American democracy. Former Georgia Attorney General Jay Moore told The Guardian, "I hate to think of a legal system that would allow the most powerful person in the country to go unchallenged when he has abdicated his highest priority, that being to keep American citizens safe. Donald Trump's conduct on that day was not unlike a mob boss."
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zayed Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. So when we were talking about mediating in the good sense, between people who are at dispute with each other, or mediating between two people wanting to get married, or finding a spouse for a brother, finding a spouse for a sister. And we said that is one of the greatest forms of ibadah, and also something that will very positively contribute to a better society. At the same time, there's something that we should always remember as well, and that is that we should never be a part of mediating for the purpose of evil, for the purpose of bad, for the purpose of wrong, for the purpose of haram. And I think that's something that should be mentioned, in the sense of we should never be involved in anything that would lead to something bad or evil or haram. That's exactly why the next topic is when we hear the common statements given to us by Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, in that, are you going to be a part of the cause, a part of the solution, or are you a part of the problem? Are you contributing to the betterment of society or to the detriment of the society? And this is a genuine question that you really, really need to ask yourself. You know, what am I doing in this world? What am I doing to make things better? Or am I doing things to make it worse? When I am doing this, or when I am saying that, or when I am being a part of this, what is it that I'm genuinely doing? And I think this is an issue that, you know, we tend to undermine as far as its value is concerned, because we brush it off very, very easily, especially with all these social demands that we can see in today's society. And that's why Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, "Man amara bisu'in," whoever commands, this is a part of a long hadith, whoever commands or orders something bad, أو دل عليه, or introduces someone or guides someone to it, أو أشار به, or points towards it, or points towards it, فهو شريك, then they are a partner in crime, pretty much, you know. The same way as al-dallu ala al-khayr kafa'ilihi, someone who introduces you to something good, is like as if you yourself, you're doing it. If you introduce someone to something good, it's like as if you're doing it. The same thing when it comes to something bad. That's why there's so much of a recommendation for us to avoid and be away of any kind of contribution towards that which is bad, that which is munkar. Not going to talk about munkar here, because that's going to be the topic that we will be speaking about in the next segment. We do understand that in the case of respecting the rights of other people and remembering that they have choices that they want to make. If they're good choices, then we also want to be a part of it. But if they are bad choices, then we don't want anything to do with it at all. Should you be the voice of the zalim, or should you be the voice of the mazloom? I think that's a very important point. How are we allowing things to spread in the bad way if we are people who supposedly want to defend the good way? Imam Ali alayhi salam, this is exactly why he says, "Kun lil mazloomi awnan wa lil zalimi khasma." Be the supporter, be the assistant of the oppressed, and be the adversary, be the opponent of the zalim, of the oppressor. You know, you need to be the thorn in the oppressor's eye, and you need to be the closest of friends to the oppressed person. Whoever they may be, however they may be, you know, you are their voice, you are going to be their brother, you're going to be their sister, you're going to be what they lean on, you're going to be their hope in life if you were to stand for them.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree,
امام همونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامش گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Imam Sadiq Salamullahi Alayh, he says, مَا مِن مُؤْمِنٍ يُعِينُ مُؤْمِنًا مَظْلُومًا. There is no believer who assists another, a fellow oppressed believer, except that what they do is better, fasting for a whole month and doing i'tikaf in al-Masjid al-Haram. So what we're talking about is Nasrul Mazloom, and that's exactly why in a long hadith, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq salamullahi alayhi, he describes the qualities of a believer. And then he says, وَيَنْصُرُ الْمَظْلُومِ. And a believer is someone who supports and assists the oppressed. وَيَرْحَمُ الْمِسْكِينِ. And they have mercy on the poor, on the destitute. And then he says, and a believer, he undergoes difficulties. نَفْسُهُ مِنْهُ فِي عَنَائِن. Which means that, you know, a believer has hardships. You know, they're always, you know, finding it difficult in life. But they don't allow that to go out into the public. They don't allow that to spill outside. And that's why Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, وَالنَّاسُ مِنْهُ فِي رَاحَ. That people are comfortable, or people don't have any problems from him. You know, although he is or she is going through difficulty or and hardship and things like that, but they don't allow it to have an effect on the way that they are dealing with other people. You know, unfortunately, sometimes you see that someone who is very stressed or someone who is anxious or someone who has problems, you know, they bring their hardships out verbally by, you know, letting it out on other people. For example, you know, if you have a problem with, you know, this or that, you know, why are you throwing it onto me, or why are you letting it out onto me? You know, this hadith says, وَالنَّاسُ مِنْهُ فِي رَاحَةٍ. That people are free of any problems coming from this individual. وَالْحَمْدُ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.